Percent of the summer Arctic sea ice melts and shale oil races up there to drop $500 million drill bits down to profit off the death throes of the planet. We have very, very little time left. For those of us who are parents, I think we have a moral imperative on behalf of our children, on behalf of the next generation whose future is being robbed of them, to stand up. So that even if we fail, that generation can look back at us and say, they tried. And in the end, it is about making a moral commitment to affirm life and to defy what Hannah Arendt calls radical evil. I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. And that is the battle that for all of us who care about this country and care about those who come after us must stand up and begin to carry out. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges on moral imperatives. He spoke in Helena, Montana. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist. He writes a weekly column for truthdig.org and is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, AR is independent. We are supported by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard elsewhere, such as Richard Wolff, Cornel West, Michelle Alexander, Noam Chomsky, Vandana Shiva, and David Suzuki. We also have a series of Chris Hedges programs and an extensive Howard Zinn archive. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Chris Hedges on Moral Imperatives, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Shane Castle. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
KBOO is proud to present a live broadcast of the Inner City Blues Festival, a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon from the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter at North Lombard in Portland, Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. Hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Portland School Board elections are May 19th. What's your question?
My name is Vern Crouch, and I'm a small business owner, and I have put six kids through Portland Public Schools, and I've often wondered where is the transparency and where the money is going.
Tune in to KBOO April 27th through 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Sex Workers film series hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the film A Kiss for Gabriella will be shown Tuesday, April 21st at 7 p.m. Gabriella Lita is the first sex worker to run for Brazilian Congress. A Kiss for Gabriella tells the story of her 2010 campaign as she faces 822 opponents and challenges a male-dominated political system to see if a sex worker, activist, wife, mother, and cultural icon can beat the odds and win the election. Again, that's A Kiss for Gabriella, Tuesday, April 21st at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 3 minutes after 10, excuse me. Coming up at 11 on Stage and Studio, host Emae Roberts takes a tour of the new location of Shaking the Tree Theater with artistic director Samantha Vandemerva. We learn about their new production of Suddenly Last Summer, a 90-minute one-act play by Tennessee Williams. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, we'll hear about the Black Arts Movement, started by Amiri Baraka. The Black Arts Movement was once described by Time magazine as the single most controversial moment in the history of African-American literature, possibly in American literature as a whole. Up next, Eric Cascadia is off today. Let's go straight to Flashpoints.
Flashpoints. We'll look at the Iran deal as the debate moves back to the U.S. and into the U.S. Congress. Will the deal stick? And what are the implications if it does? Also, supporters of Umi Abu-Jamal say he is facing a grave medical situation and urgent action is needed. And the Electronic Intifada, hosted by Nora Barros-Friedman, will return with another report. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are joined by Robert Perry. He is the founder of ConsortiumNews.com. He's been a longtime reporter. He is the winner of the George Polk Award for Investigative Reporting. Bob, welcome back to Flashpoints. You've been doing such a good job at Consortium dealing with the Ukraine, and it is such an important story given that there is a nuclear contingent, if you will. I just wanted you to sort of bring us up to speed. What's going on? We see the president there is willing to hold a referendum leading to a more decentralized state. What's going on? What's going on underneath the surface here?
Well, Dennis, it looks like they might be moving back to a more of a full-scale war. There was the effort by Chancellor Merkel to bring about an agreement called Minsk II, which actually had the promise of resolving this, but it required talks between the Kiev regime and the ethnic Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine, and that was what was envisioned, that they would somehow have these meetings, they'd hold some elections, they'd then have this constitutional reform to give extensive autonomy to the eastern sections. But the parliament in Kiev then decided to essentially throw in a poison pill in the legislation that dealt with this by requiring, in effect, the rebels to first surrender. And after the rebels surrendered, then the Kiev regime said they would then deal with this other stuff, whether there'd be an election and so forth. So that means that probably instead of moving to some kind of reasonable, peaceful settlement, which certainly was possible, instead, it appears to be moving more to a resumption of the war. And over the weekend, this is according to the German press, the Ukrainian government gave to one of the leading neo-Nazis in Ukraine a position inside the army. And some of the neo-Nazi and far-right militias that were used to attack the ethnic Russians in the east are now being brought into the full-scale military. So what you're seeing is a ramping up, really, especially in Kiev, in preparation for this resumption of war. And I'm sure that the ethnic Russian rebels are doing the best they can, too, to train and prepare for this renewed fighting that's expected.
Now, just to be clear, when you're talking about neo-Nazis, that's not hyperbole, right? That's based on...
No. Some of them are very proud of it. One of the odd things is that even the mainstream U.S. press, which has put blinders on about the neo-Nazi problem, will from time to time acknowledge that, for instance, the Azov Battalion is filled with Nazis. They have swastikas, they have SS symbols, and this really isn't that unusual since Western Ukraine has been a hotbed, really going back to before World War II, of these far-right movements, which during World War II joined the SS in the persecution and extermination of Jews and Poles. Remember that Babi Yar, one of the most notorious atrocities against Jews in that part of the world, occurred outside Kiev in Ukraine. So you had these neo-Nazis who had despised they despised the Soviet Union, and so they joined with Hitler on his side in the war. And despite the defeat of Hitler, some of these groups sort of maintained themselves in places like Lviv and other parts of Western Ukraine, and they became a key factor in the February 2014 Maidan protests. They became the muscle. The so-called Maidan commandant was this fellow Parabui, who was a well-known Nazi. He organized something called the Social Nationalist Party instead of the National Socialist Party. But these were Nazis, and they provided the muscle to overthrow the Yanukovych regime back then. And then they were incorporated into the National Guard, these so-called volunteer battalions. And even the New York Times, despite its efforts to not notice, has reported that the way that the war was fought in the East was to have the army firing artillery into the cities, and then they'd send in these neo-Nazi and other far-right battalions who were very ramped up to kill people, and they would send them into the cities and go door to door and kill people. So that was how the war was being fought until the Russians apparently provided more help to the ethnic Russian rebels, and they were able to turn the tide of the war last summer. And that led to the first ceasefire, which was very fragile, and then the neo-Nazis continued to operate, running basically death squads in the parts of eastern Ukraine they controlled, and that led to further fighting. And ultimately, the second ceasefire, known as Minsk II, which included a plan for resolving the conflict peacefully, but that required legislation in Kiev. And instead of passing the legislation as planned, this poison pill was thrown in, which really sets the stage for more fighting.
Now, so it's safe to say, it's fair to say that President Poroshenko and his strong supporters in the U.S. government are, if you will, clearly working partners with these neo-Nazis, these extreme right-wing parts of the government. This is a close working relationship? It has to be,
yes,
right?
Yes, it has to be, because these are the people that are actually doing the fighting. It's a bit like some places in when you have Saudi Arabia supporting some of the extremist jihadists in places like Syria. The people that are doing the fiercest fighting are often the most extreme elements. And that's the same case in Ukraine, where the people really ramped up and motivated to go kill ethnic Russians are these neo-Nazis. The Ukrainian military has been rather ambivalent about being involved in the civil war. They'll fire from a distance, but they don't want to go face to face with people. But that's been different with these extremist groups. And so, and you've also had some of the oligarchs, like Kolomovsky, who was given his own province in the East to govern, and he was funding a number of these extremist groups, including the Azov Battalion, which is the most clearly neo-Nazi of the groups. And he recently, in a fight for control of some of the energy companies in Ukraine, because there's now this, the economy is quite damaged, and so some of the oligarchs are fighting each other for the scraps, he sent his armed men into Kiev to, in a showdown over who would control one of these businesses, and that ultimately led to him being ousted by the other key oligarch, Poroshenko, who's the president. But Kolomovsky still has a great deal of control over these so-called volunteer battalions.
All right. We're speaking with Robert Perry. He is the founder, editor of the ConsortiumNews.com. We've been talking about the Ukraine, but Bob, you've also been doing a great deal of good reporting, you and others at Consortium, dealing with the Iran situation. Now we have this sort of the working parts of an agreement. It seems to be moving from that part of the world to the United States, the U.S. Senate. You write in a recent piece, the April 2 framework agreement with Iran represents more than just a diplomatic deal to prevent nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. It marks a crossroad that offers a possible path for the American Republic to regain its footing and turn away from endless war. You want to talk about that, Bob?
Well, I don't want to sound too Pollyannish, Dennis, but and
you wrote it.
Well, I know I wrote it, but sometimes I
get carried away.
Excuse me of being so negative and cynical. I guess I try to respond to that sometimes,
right.
but basically this is a hopeful trend. I mean, this is a possibility. It's a moment when the United States has through at least President Obama and his administration have decided that they are going to try to work out a reasonable deal with Iran rather than do what the neoconservatives have been demanding, which is, first of all, throw this deal out the window, whatever it is, and really move to bombing Iran. And that was laid out even on the op-ed pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post by people like John Bolton and Joshua Moravchik, two leading neocons, who at least were honest enough to say, you know, whatever they say about alternatives, once we get rid of this negotiation thing, we have to move to bombing. And that's that would have been an extremely dangerous move, because not only would it not really have solved the problem of this Iran nuclear program, it might actually have pushed them into building a nuclear bomb once they repaired things, but it could have also caused huge environmental and disaster and civilian casualties in vast numbers. These are active nuclear plants that were going to be bombed. So, and it further could have disrupted situations throughout the Middle East, where whatever one thinks of the Iranians, they have provided efforts to stabilize the region. They are the key figures pushing back against the Islamic State when the Islamic State made its dramatic gains over last summer and almost overran Erbil, the